From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Donna Williams is an autistic woman who can do what very few autistics can. She can describe what it's like to be shut off from the world. We broadcast an interview with her over a year ago. On today's Fresh Air, Donna Williams joins us again, this time to talk about her unusual gift for language. Also today, the human instinct to learn and understand language. We talk with psycholinguist Steven Pinker about why he thinks language is based in biology. He has a new book about how the mind creates language. And rock historian Ed Ward has been living in Berlin, where he says the new hip language is English. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. New York City police have arrested a Lebanese man in connection with the shootings of four Orthodox Jewish students yesterday. New York's police commissioner says the man is being charged with 15 counts of attempted murder, as well as several assault and weapons charges. One of the victims has been declared brain dead, although he's still on life support. A second victim is in extremely critical condition. The United Nations commander in Sarajevo says there's a decrease in the general level of violence in Bosnia since the NATO deadline took effect a week and a half ago. NPR's Scott Simon reports from Sarajevo.
While the city of Mostar is still besieged, UN sources say that five shells fell there last night. A month ago, says Lieutenant Colonel William Aikman, 25 to 30 would have been expected. Once again last night, here in Sarajevo, there was some shooting reported, but no casualties. The United Nations says that the ceasefire signed between the Bosnians and Croats will call for all heavy weapons to be withdrawn from a 10-mile exclusion zone along the front lines and collected together in five sites by March 7th. Michael Rose, the UN commander in Sarajevo, has said he will need 2,000 to 3,000 more troops to accomplish that task. The force required to guard abandoned Serb weapons that had been firing shells into Sarajevo is still preventing the physical repair of much of the city here, including electric lines and water. This is Scott Simon in Sarajevo.
The Russian government says it is ready to join NATO's Partnership for Peace. The program sets up military links with former Soviet bloc countries. Some former Soviet satellites like the program. They say it's a step toward full NATO membership. The BBC's Robert Parsons reports.
The confirmation that Russia is prepared to join the Partnership for Peace will have come as a considerable relief to NATO, which has been alarmed by the recent chill in relations between Moscow and the alliance. Russia has frequently warned NATO not to accept the East European states as full members of the alliance and was fiercely critical of NATO's threat to use airstrikes in Bosnia. NATO sent a high-level delegation to Moscow this week to convince the Russians of the merits of the partnership and to reassure them that the idea did not in any way diminish its special status as the heir to a superpower. The delegation has returned to Brussels with assurances that Russia will now join the partnership, which NATO regards as the centerpiece of its efforts to open up the alliance to its former enemies in Central and Eastern Europe. But no date has been set, and the Russian parliament may well oppose the decision.
Robert Parsons reporting. Chief Justice William Rehnquist has denied Senator Bob Packwood's request to keep his diaries to himself. The Senate Ethics Committee wants to look at them as part of its investigation into charges of sexual misconduct lodged against the Oregon Republican. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 18 points at 3,827. The Nasdaq is down almost 6 at 782. This is NPR. The government says sales of new homes plunged just over 20% in January. The agency blames severe winter weather and rising interest rates. The Northeast was the only region to rise despite the bad weather. The Departments of Commerce and Housing and Urban Development say this is the worst report in 14 years. The government also says Americans' personal income dropped 0.3% in January, but consumer spending was up 0.5%. Spending makes up 2/3 of the nation's economic activity. Tomorrow's planned liftoff of the space shuttle Columbia has been scrubbed. Bad weather in Florida has forced NASA to reschedule the launch for Friday. Dave Pignanelli reports.
NASA managers decided to call off tomorrow's attempt after forecasters gave officials a less than 10% chance of good weather at launch time. Forecasters at the Johnson Space Center in Houston and at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station both agree that weather patterns are predictable enough to guarantee bad weather for tomorrow. The problem is with high surface winds at the launch site and at the shuttle's emergency landing strip. The countdown for the launch of Columbia and its five-member crew is now on hold until tomorrow evening. NASA hopes to send the crew on its 14-day mission Friday morning at 8:53 a.m. Eastern Time. Forecasters say the weather on Friday should be nearly perfect. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
Mexican rebel and government negotiators say they've reached an initial agreement to end the peasant uprising in southern Mexico. The government says it'll respond quickly to rebel demands for electricity, health clinics, good roads, and education. A government negotiator says authorities will launch a large-scale program to help the communities that backed the rebels this past New Year's Day. The ice dancers from Great Britain, Jane Torval and Christopher Dean, say they're retiring from competitive skating. The couple received a bronze medal at the recent Winter Olympics. They say they will not take part in this month's World Championships being held in Japan. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The world of the autistic is a great mystery to us because most autistic people cannot communicate anything about their condition. One exception is Donna Williams, a gifted writer whose 1992 memoir, Nobody Nowhere, was a bestseller. Perhaps you remember her interview on this show. Now she has a second memoir, Somebody Somewhere, which is the occasion for our second interview. Williams was born in Australia in 1963. As a girl, she was labeled deaf, retarded, disturbed, and insane. When she was in her early 20s, she wrote the story of her life and gave it to a psychiatrist, hoping he could tell her what was wrong with her. This led to both the diagnosis of autism and the publication of her first book. When Williams is overwhelmed by any kind of change, new sensation, or overstimulation, she goes into what she describes as a state of total shutdown. Before we hear our new interview, let's listen to how Williams explained shutdown when we spoke in 1992.
Because for me, many things are very single track. It's like everything is on a scale. And if you imagine that scale is from 0 to 5, then most people's highest point is 3. So if they feel emotions, for example, their most extreme emotions are 3. After that, your body starts to shake. After that, you can't process the meaning of what's happening to you. After that, it's like going slowly into a state of shock, and that's what happens for me. But the kind of experiences that give other people a sense of 3 can give me a sense of 5, which means that the physical response looks like having a fit. Every part of my body will be in tremors. It feels painful to feel that emotion. And then the only way over that is a complete, like, it's like walls go up. It's like going into a state of shock, and next thing, there is no meaning, but at least all the pain's gone. You feel dead. But for me, this happens also with my vision. It happens with touch. It happens with hearing. Nothing is familiar. You say a word to me, cup, I won't know what it means. It's just a sound. It's a series of sounds, and I'll keep trying and trying to put it together, and I can't. If you get all those kinds of shutdown together, including the retrieval of words for language, you're in big trouble. It feels like hell. It feels like death, and you're just totally terrified. It's like being buried alive.
As you can hear, the world is a pretty threatening place for Donna Williams. Although she is eloquent, there are certain conditions she needs in order to communicate. For instance, it's much easier for her to write than to speak. Her thoughts flow most easily in the mechanical act of typing, and typing allows her to express herself without the added confusion of social interaction. She asked me to fax her my questions in advance, something I ordinarily would never do, so she could read them, think about them, and write down her thoughts. She also asked me to speak with her before the interview so she could get acquainted with the sound of my voice. Speak slowly, she told me. In this second interview, I spoke with Donna Williams about her gift for language. Do you remember the first words and ideas that you understood?
Words and ideas develop separately for me. So I had ideas and feelings that had no words, that I had no words for, and I had lots of words that I had no mental pictures, ideas or feelings for. I understood that words to do with toileting, for example, mean that what I now know as something like disgust or being fed up or lack of acceptance. And I had a kind of little inkling of the negative consequences of something like that. I knew that being called a nut was meant that I couldn't be understood, and that I was closed out from comprehensible connection to other people. I also knew that being a nut created a kind of self-rejection in me, because I was repulsed by being the thing that created the distance and rejection that came with being a nut. I remember some nice words for me, words like Pop and Nana and my father's name, and for me that had a meaning, which was getting things, and the voice patterns and movement patterns that I liked would come. I remember words like cat that I associated with the sounds and textures that I felt safe with, or shoes that I would associate with a sound or a feel of those things, or the familiarity. But the way that I put meaning and words together when I did get that, I think was a bit more sensory and consequential than it is perhaps for other people. Literal meaning was something that took a while to get to.
Was it exciting to discover language?
When you ask, was it exciting to discover language, sounds like a person standing on a cliff and suddenly they fly. And it's not like that, because it assumes that everything happened overnight and there was some major magical breakthrough. For a non-verbal autistic person who then suddenly starts speaking in a functional, not dysfunctional way, that might be so perhaps for them. But for me, being echolalic, this breakthrough didn't happen suddenly like that, because it took a lot of time and effort to more and more refine what was coming out, to keep mental track of it and process it with meaning of what was coming in as well. To experience literal comprehension jump from, say, 25% up to 50 or 70%, that feels freeing, and it made me love life like everything was all new. But it's not the same big breakthrough as, say, someone who has never said a word and then says a sentence. Also to experience a depth of processing beyond that, to know what something meant in relation to me personally, or for words to move me, was for me to be touched in a kind of a very magic way. And it was like a big door opening up. And then I thought, can this happen more, with more sentences? Yes. But these were gradual things, and they took a lot of work and a lot of energy. And they weren't passive miracles. I think I earned my miracles.
As a child, were you able to echo what other people said before you understood that words had meaning?
I think that's what is meant by the word echolalia. And that's what I feel I had.
Were people ever angry with you for not responding to what they said to you?
A lot of people thought when I echoed what they said that I was verifying what they were saying. And then when I didn't follow through with what they thought I'd verified, they thought that I was forgetful or stubborn, or I didn't care, or I couldn't be bothered. And sometimes people thought that I was just playing, and they told me to stop it. But when I was echoing them, it was sometimes to try to get some meaning from what they said, as though that if I said it to myself, some meaning might connect. But other times, when I was in a state of overload, the whole idea that there was any possibility of meaning being in words had just dropped out. It was missing. So I just assumed that they were making noises and pulling faces and putting all this noise in their voice. And sometimes those noises and movements and things caused a sensory or compulsive reactions in me. So I repeated those, or I played with those things. But I wasn't playing with the people, and I wasn't ignoring them, and I wasn't meaning to be silly. I took things very seriously as a person in a state of meaning shutdown can take.
If people got angry at you for not responding to what they were saying, did you understand their anger?
When people got angry with me for not responding with understanding or apparent caring, I usually just then mirrored their anger. Some people had a sense of humour about this and they just gave up. Some people would just call me mad or stupid or deaf. And later I learned from the TV that if people acted angry, that the other person should act sorry. And so then I started doing that and that worked a bit better. But then I'd do all the same things again and again that I'd said I was sorry for. And then people got fed up with me for being sorry without changing, without making changes based on the sorriness. And so it creates even more problems. That's where I think you have to have a look at some of these things where people, where autistic people get taught of how to act. And then the things that they get taught then might create even more problems. It's one thing to make someone appear functional. It's another thing to then throw them in the deep end without any inner connections to those, that outer appearance of being functional.
How did you learn to read and write?
I learned to read when I was small. That meaning was meant to go together with words in reading didn't happen till much later, but by then I could already read very advanced books, but all without meaning, just for the strings and the sound. My trouble with meaning, with reading with meaning, was the same as trouble with hearing with meaning. And my writing, though, wasn't so much the same. Up until I was about 11, I didn't write much beyond a sentence or a word, except, of course, copied from what was on the board. And then I learned to write facts that I'd learned from encyclopedias, and I got a typewriter around then and I started typing lists, and those lists became kind of list poems and of made up of image words, and those image words became more advanced poems over the next years. And later I became able to write when I went back to school at 19, but mostly factual impersonal writing. I learned to write letters as a character in my 20s, but personal writing from feelings was always for myself in private.
Do you find any pleasure in casual conversation?
I find some pleasure sometimes in some word plays. I sometimes find some pleasure in using words to learn things that I want to know about. The purpose of casual conversation doesn't connect for me most of the time. I'm very tolerant of people's casual conversation, or I try to be. I know it's part of their life that the other people take seriously, but I can't live it very well, just perform it, and that wastes my life and it wastes theirs. So I don't bother massaging their ego with a cheap performance of how I can mimic what they call conversation.
Does the quality of a person's voice affect whether you feel comfortable talking with someone?
I have some trouble with certain pitches and intonations, so I find it easier to process the words of someone who uses much less intonation or speaks gently and slowly and rhythmically and very peacefully, because that gives me more processing time, and then I have less overload and there's less meaning shutdown, and I can process things in deeper levels. So that's good.
Did you ever echo other people's emotions without feeling or understanding those emotions, much in the same way that you used to echo what people were saying without understanding the meaning of their words?
I learned to mirror emotional responses, and later I learned emotional scenarios of what emotional responses are meant to receive what other ones. But one of the problems from this is that then you have to act as though you really meant the response that you showed. So if you acted like you had love, then you had to do what a person does when they are meant to feel love. If you act like you have anger, then you have to fight. If you act like you have happiness, then you have to act like you enjoyed something. The consequences of showing that these things weren't real was, for me, things like being called mad, being weird, abnormal, and the being rejected and excluded. And these things might not sound too bad. You might think, why doesn't a person who's having all this trouble then just choose that and be excluded by these rubbish people? But when you don't have real connected emotions in place of all the performed ones, then you haven't got any direction of your own to go off to. And so I often stayed in bad situations simply because I didn't have any picture in my head of any other possible one and no idea of how I might cope in another unimaginable situation.
My guest is Donna Williams. Her new memoir about being autistic is called Somebody Somewhere. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Donna Williams. She's written a second memoir about being autistic called Somebody Somewhere. In your book, you wrote that when you were young, you studied TV sitcoms to learn how to behave like a good girl. What did you learn to do from watching sitcoms?
And the biggest thing that I learned from the sitcoms was how to make exits and intros. The sitcom characters make very clear exits and intros, and the result of this was that I spent most of my time when I was with other people running through a repertoire of exits and intros. So I would always be leaving the room constantly just to enter again, because in the time when I was there, I didn't know what else to do. But the exits and intros were often interesting and looked good and made big impression and caused reaction in them that could then cause triggered reaction in me that I mistook for interaction. I got nothing out of that, though, and so while they were being entertained and they were living a life, I was just playing a real-life sitcom. I thought the other thing of this was that the other people, I thought, were doing the same thing as well, and so I just thought that sitcoms were a version of the life on television. And so for me, if you want to talk of breakthroughs, a big one for me was learning that this was not what was happening with the other people, and also that it wasn't real life.
Did you understand that sitcoms were supposed to be funny, and do you understand humor now?
I didn't understand that the sitcoms were meant to be funny, because for me the whole purpose of watching them was to accumulate. But I understood that I was meant to act like they were funny, and I was meant to laugh when other people laughed, even if the people on the TV laughing, the sort of canned laughter. And I understand now, roughly, that they're meant to be funny, but that's kind of like with a translation to what I find funny. I understand my own humour, and sometimes I understand very simple visual humour of other people, but spoken and complex humour is almost impossible to process for me, because I'm still often just managing on a literal level.
Do you know other people who are what's been described as high-functioning autistics, like yourself? And are you more comfortable with them?
We've met other people like ourselves, but we get a lot of letters from other autistic people, able autistic people. We get letters from autistic people who are married, who have children, who are in professions, who drive cars, who have an education, all sorts of things, in many different countries. But as about whether I feel more comfortable with them, sometimes yes, but sometimes also no, because that some of them are like how I was, and they are so riddled with compulsion in place of want, or stored behaviour in place of self, that it's like being with someone who's got a spiritual cancer. And even though I can understand it and feel for it, it is sometimes a reminder of what I'm trying very hard to overcome.
Do you think you can continue to become more and more a part of the world?
I don't really understand what you mean, but if you mean things like go to dinner parties and blah, blah, no, because my processing problems make situations almost impossible to cope with in one piece, and impossible to enjoy because there's no processing time to be part of things in a non-stored way or feel for what I'm doing. But if you mean, will I more and more be able to feel for other people's experiences or words or actions in a way that's more than just tolerating them? I think yes, provided at the same time that they don't deny me my right and ability to define the boundaries that I can function within and the right to modify my environment if I need to.
Donna, can I ask you one question that is not on the paper?
I don't know.
If you like, I can ask the question, and then you can decide if you want to answer it or not.
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. We talked a little bit about how you learned the meaning of language and how you learned to write. Is it comfortable for you to speak and to put meaning into your words as you speak?
I want to tell her how I understood her question and how it is to try to answer her.
Okay.
As you tell me that, I have to decide in your speaking what part is context and what part is question, because I only have enough time and space to make sense of your question, and your context is irrelevant. So I put up with all your noise, and then I have to try to select which part's the question. So I have to get to the end and then replay that last part that you said and find your question. Then I have to think of what it means by saying it inside. Then I think, what do I think about that? And nothing comes. You asked, I'm going to try to work out again what you said. You said, is it hard for me to put meaning together as I'm speaking?
Yes, and right.
It's hard. I'm sure if I sat here with the computer, it would all just happen. But when I write, it's not with any thinking. Do you understand?
It happens very naturally when you write.
No, it happens without thinking, just comes out.
Uh-huh.
My thinking is on the page.
Yes.
It's not in my head. And so I sit waiting for the thinking to happen, and it's not happening. But if I have ideas that do come up, maybe separate from your question, something else to tell, there's not so much mechanics when I don't have to answer in relation to another person. But even then, retrieving the right words is difficult, because sometimes I'll look for the word and it will come out more describing the sensory experience of the picture in my head than the actual literal word interpretation of the image. If, for example, I want to retrieve even one single word, like the word paper, I might go to get the word paper and I'm blocked, and then I'll say thing to write on and I'll get blocked, and then I'll say big white flat and it will come out. How's the other person going to know what I'm saying? Now, if you take that example of from more than a word and you look at a sentence, it is much easier to use a stored sentence than one that comes from my own self that I haven't had time in writing to retrieve. Can you understand me? Can you make sense of that?
I can. I really think I can. And you've explained, I think, why it's easier for you to write and to read the questions than it is for me to ask you questions and for you to just speak in response.
Yes.
Yes. Well, Donna, I want to thank you very much for doing the interview. Thank you.
Goodbye, Terry.
Donna Williams' new memoir is called Somebody Somewhere, Breaking Free from the World of Autism. Her first memoir, Nobody Nowhere, has been published in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Steven Pinker writes that by the age of 3, a child is a grammatical genius because of the child's ability to follow the rules of language without directly being taught. And Pinker doesn't chalk it up to the child's ability to imitate. Coming up, we talk with psycholinguist Steven Pinker about what he calls our innate sense of language. Pinker is the author of the new book, The Language Instinct: How the Mind Creates Language. Also, commentator Ed Ward reports on the new hip language in Berlin, English. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Yasser Arafat has sent a letter to Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin outlining conditions for resuming peace talks between the PLO and Israel. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian sources say the letter from Arafat was carried to Jerusalem by Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat. Israel Radio says it lists 3 conditions the PLO wants met before peace talks resume: the disarming of settlers, the dismantlement of settlements in Palestinian population centers, and an international presence in the occupied territories. Palestinian sources say the PLO is still committed to the peace process, but wants to get as much as possible from the Israelis first. The Israeli government spokesman Uri Dromi said there would be no concessions before talks resume, but said if the Palestinians come back to the negotiating table, they will find Israel ready to do everything it can to reach an agreement quickly. He indicated that message has been communicated to the Palestinians. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
The Bosnian Serb leader is criticizing the United States for supporting his enemy, the Bosnian government. Radovan Karadzic says the United Nations, not the U.S., should take a forceful role in Bosnian peace efforts. Karadzic, who's in Moscow, says Washington is taking sides in the Bosnian fight. He says the U.S. should take its example from Russia, which is impartial and reliable. Observers say the Russians support Serbia and Bosnian Serbs. Karadzic is doubting that a new peace agreement between Bosnian Croats and the Bosnian government will work. He says the real reason for the agreement is to force the Bosnian Serbs to give up more land. The House got back to business today with one of its senior members in attendance. 84-year-old William Natcher of Kentucky was wheeled into the House chamber on a gurney to keep his perfect voting record intact. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The House put off its business yesterday because Natcher was in the hospital, and House leaders agreed to accommodate the Appropriations Committee chairman to keep his voting streak intact. Today, Natcher was brought to the Capitol by ambulance and accompanied by a doctor and a nurse from the Bethesda Naval Hospital. As reporters looked on, he was wheeled the short distance from his office to the House floor. He waved and then cast his vote in favor of the journal, essentially the minutes of the previous day's session. Natcher is said to be suffering from a heart ailment. He looked frail and was attached to oxygen tubes. House Speaker Thomas Foley said he has not received any sort of resignation letter from Natcher. Natcher was first elected in 1953. Going into today's session, he had cast a record 18,397 consecutive votes. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street today after rebounding from a 50-point drop early in the day. The Dow was up 22.5 points to end at 3,831.74. This is NPR. The Clinton administration reportedly has decided to renew a trade provision that would allow it to raise tariffs on Japanese goods sold in the United States. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
Reports in today's New York and Los Angeles Times say that an announcement on renewal of the provision, known as Super 301, could be made soon. Super 301 was part of U.S. trade law in 1989 and 90 and is intended to identify nations that raise the greatest barriers to open trade. Focus on the provision began last month when talks between President Clinton and Japanese Prime Minister Morihiro Hosokawa fell apart. In the week after Hosokawa's visit, the White House announced it was prepared to impose several $100 million worth of sanctions on Japanese products in retaliation for the obstacles the Motorola Corporation met in trying to sell its cellular telephone service in the Tokyo area. Japan said today that a U.S. move to redeploy Super 301 could hamper Tokyo's efforts to draft market-opening measures, but added the U.S. step would not automatically prompt retaliation. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A U.S. diplomat says China must clean up its human rights record. John Shattuck, the Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, says he held detailed talks with Chinese officials on these matters. President Clinton has attached human rights reforms to this year's renewal of China's most favored nation trading status. Shattuck says Beijing knows exactly what it has to do to keep the MFN trading status, but a Chinese foreign ministry official repeated Beijing's line that human rights and trade issues should not be linked. Vietnam says it's reached an initial agreement with the United States to open liaison offices in each other's countries. The United States has also reached an initial agreement to settle claims against Vietnam from the war. The Vietnamese Foreign Ministry says 2 days of talks in Hanoi ended well yesterday. The talks are the first major negotiations between both countries since the 1973 Paris Peace Agreement that ended American involvement in Vietnam. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Language is one of the main things that separates humans from animals. Many linguists are certain that human language is part of human biology, even though no one has yet found a gene or an organ responsible for language. Steven Pinker is an expert on language and the mind. He directs the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at MIT. He's written a new book about how the mind creates language called The Language Instinct.
The explanation for the logic of language, for how it works as it does, and for how people manage to speak and understand language so naturally, comes from our biological constitution, from the way that the genes put our brain together during development. The fact that languages are built out of nouns and verbs and phrases and so on isn't something that each child has to relearn, and it isn't something that had to be invented at a certain point in history and then transmitted from generation to generation. But that part of the language is something that the child is, in a sense, born with and uses to learn the particular nuances of his or her own language, that is, English or Japanese.
Each language, whether it's English or Chinese or a Native American language, each language is so different phonetically and structurally from each other. If there's like an innate instinct for language, how come there's so many different structures and sounds in the languages of different cultures?
Well, if you look a bit below the surface languages, they're actually built out of the same stuff. So even though obviously the sound of a Native American language strikes the ear as very different from English, I mean, you can't understand a word of it, but if you play it in a spectrogram, if you look at the principles that speakers of, say, Native American languages use to put words together, they're not that different from the ones that you see in English or Yiddish or any other language. So no language, for example, uses Donald Duck noises or scraping teeth. All languages combine a universal inventory of gestures and just pick different ones from this universal inventory and combine them. So part of it is that they're not the languages aren't that different to begin with. The difference is why there isn't just one language, why evolution didn't just go all the way and give us all Esperanto in the genes instead of having these 4,000 or 5,000 languages, is a bit of a mystery. My hunch is that it's because no two people are genetically identical, and the whole point of language is to be able to communicate with other people. If I had a language that was 100% innate, and so did you, over a number of generations, because of mutation and genetic recombination, the languages would fall out of register. And it may be that part of the ability to speak is the ability to synchronize our language with the language of everyone else in the community. That's what children would do when they learn to speak. And that this flexibility was built in to keep everyone in sync.
What do you think is the most convincing evidence that there is an innate instinct for language?
I don't know if there would be one smoking gun, but I think there are lots of bits that add up to the same conclusion. One of them would be the fact that language is universal, and in fact, complex language is universal, and complex language of the same kind is universal. So no matter what remote highland tribe you visit on the planet, they will always have language. They will not have any kind of primitive or Stone Age language. There's no such thing. The language of people with Stone Age technology is often fantastically grammatically complex, more complex in many ways than the European languages that we hold in such high regard, like English and French and Latin. The languages will always be built out of the same elements, of case and agreement and nouns and verbs and subjects and objects. The fact that children universally seem to pick up language very quickly and without much, without anything in the way of lessons. I think almost any parent will be struck by the fact that for months their child will just be saying things like "all gone outside" or "more juice," and then within a few months, the kid is talking in fantastically fluent, complex grammatical sentences, and so that a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old can actually be arguing with a parent over what to do next in a form of speech that both sides can share.
Why is it so much easier for children to learn new languages than for adults? I mean, a child, if he's or she is exposed to it, can pick up, I think, several languages, where when an adult moves to a different country, it's so difficult for that adult to learn the language of their new country.
Absolutely. Again, no one really knows, but there's a strong hunch. We know that children's brains are different from adults. A 2-year-old's brain actually has 50% more connections between brain cells than an adult's brain, and a child's brain uses 50% more energy. So that the brains are literally working harder and have more connections, and there's a strong hunch that that means that there's more room to register the information about a particular language. Our brains really do sort of solidify and fossilize as we get older. No one knows for sure that that's why it's easier for kids than for adults, but it's a good hunch.
Are scientists looking for a gene that controls language?
They're looking at a possible genetic basis for language, which is a first step in looking for a gene. Language therapists have often noticed that there are kids of normal intelligence, normal hearing, normal social skills, who just fail to develop language on schedule. At an age at which normal children have been talking for years, there are some kids who are still struggling to get words out, and often they struggle throughout life. They're not stupid. They're not autistic, they're not retarded, they just seem to have problems with language. And people who treat these children also note that it runs in families, that if a child has this language impairment, there's a good chance that there might be a brother or a father or an aunt who also has it. And so that leads you to suspect that there might be some genetic basis. I think it's been fairly well established that there is some genetic component to it. Where the 8 genes are is something that no one knows, but it may be possible to find out in the next 10 years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Steven Pinker, author of the new book, The Language Instinct, How the Mind Creates Language. He also directs the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at MIT. Back after this break, this is Fresh Air. Back with Steven Pinker, author of the new book, The Language Instinct. I know when I was young, my school teachers used to make the argument that fuzzy language, fuzzy speaking, leads to fuzzy thinking. And I've actually believed that to some extent. And you say that that's not really true, that in fact we don't think in language. We think in something else.
Yeah, I don't think we think in language. I think, surprisingly enough, for someone who spends most of his life studying language, I think language is kind of overrated. I think that we think in a number of different media. I think we think in images. I think we think in abstract propositions. And that what language is a way of converting thoughts into noises so that other people can listen to those noises and figure out what we're thinking. But I don't think that language is the thought itself. One of the reasons is that everyone knows that there can be some slippage between what you mean and what you say. You might have trouble expressing your thoughts and know that you're having trouble expressing your thoughts, or a sentence might come out and you might think, darn, that wasn't exactly what I meant to say. Let me try again. We also know that words can have more than one meaning. So when there's a newspaper headline like Stud Tires Out, which meant to notify people that stud tires had been banned, but can also be interpreted as saying that a masculine individual is fatigued.
A sex machine is puckered out.
A sex machine is puckered out. Then obviously their stud has two meanings, as does tires. Now, just saying that there are two meanings implies that there have to be these things called meanings that are not the same as words. Yeah. Similarly, when something can be a good translation or a bad translation, what does that mean? It means it conveys the meaning well or not well. That just implies that there has to be something called a meaning corresponding to a thought that's not the same as the actual noises that we make with our mouths or scratch marks we make with a pen.
I have always been told that Eskimos have either dozens or hundreds of words for the idea of snow. And I think this is always used to communicate that in different cultures you can tell that you can tell a culture's values by the words that culture uses, by the language it uses. And since snow is so important to the northern native, there's dozens or hundreds of words to describe its variations. You say that this is really not true at all, that there are dozens or hundreds of words for snow up north.
Right. It's one of these legends that gets exaggerated in each retelling. So it's true that the Eskimos have a few words for snow, and an anthropologist noted this at the turn of the century. I think he said that there were four words for snow in a particular Eskimo language. And then when that was repeated, it was seven, and then that got repeated to 12, and then to 25, and then to 50, and then to 400, and so on. And I think the reason is the one that you mentioned. Everyone needs an example to make the point that different cultures have different vocabularies. And it sure would be nice if the Eskimos had 400 words for snow, because that would make the point so well. Just like the fact that lemmings actually don't hurl themselves over cliffs and commit suicide. But it's kind of a shame, because we need a metaphor for a headlong rush into foolishness. And if they didn't, how could we refer to it? But no, Eskimos, this is when an anthropologist named Laura Martin really recently looked into the problem. She picked up a dictionary of, in one particular Eskimo language, and she found that there were two words for snow. Now, she did a bit more research, and she found you could, depending on how broad or narrow you define a word for snow, like is blizzard a word for snow, you could come up with maybe a dozen, perhaps as many as 20 in various Eskimo languages. But, of course, by the same standards, English has about a dozen words for snow. We've got hard pack and slush and sleet and blizzard and dusting and so on. It's just a factoid that was invented to make the point instead of the point coming from the fact.
Boy, I bet there's a lot of disappointed people out there.
Yeah, I've already heard from disappointed weather people, for starters.
So does the point no longer exist? Does this annihilate the point?
No, the point is surely true, but in a sense, it's kind of a boring point. I'm sure that the technician in the next booth has lots more words for bits of radio equipment than I do, and I've got more, since I like to ride bicycles, I know obscure words for various bicycle parts. And so on. When you think about it, when you forget the Eskimos, I mean, the Eskimos are exotic. They live up north in the igloos, and that seems to give an air of profundity to this observation. But when you think about it, it's really no surprise. Anyone in any area of expertise has more words than someone not in that area of expertise, and that surely is a valid point. I think the Eskimos just make it a little more exotic.
I'm wondering if you've read either of Donna Williams' books. She's an autistic woman who has this incredible gift for language in spite of her autism?
I haven't read that book, although I've heard about it, and it sounds fascinating. And there are a number of syndromes in which language and the rest of the mind can fall out of sync, which is in itself interesting because it shows that language isn't just intelligence, that they are slightly different things. In certain kinds of retardation and certain kinds of brain damage, you can get people who are highly articulate, who can sound like the most sophisticated announcer on the BBC, but score 50 on an IQ test that is in the severely retarded range. Even in Alzheimer's disease, if people have had experience with family members who have Alzheimer's might notice that despite the fact that memory is completely gone and a sense of where you are or of how the world works seems to have vanished, often Alzheimer's disease patients can speak in quite grammatical, fluent sentences. So it suggests that the brain has a number of separate circuits, some of them involved heavily in language, some of them involved in memory and everyday reasoning, and it's not just one big meatloaf.
Are there like one or two questions you're just dying to find out the answers to and you hope to find them out through your research?
I would love to find out if there are genes that help build language abilities in the brain. I would love to find out where exactly in the brain those language abilities are. I would also like to find the universal grammar that underlies all human languages, something that linguists are now groping towards but haven't yet found.
Steven Pinker, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Steven Pinker is the author of The Language Instinct. He directs the Center for Cognitive Neuroscience at MIT.
You're just too marvelous for words, like glorious, glamorous, and that old standby amorous. It's all so wonderful, I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough. I mean, they just aren't swelling up. You're much too much, you're just too very, very to ever be in a Webster's dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
Billie Holiday on Fresh Air. There's news today regarding the computer industry. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. The Clinton administration announces a new partnership among companies in this country that make computer chips. The U.S. government is planning to provide even more support for the U.S. chip industry to help it compete worldwide. In other stories, I'll have two conversations about the upcoming elections in April in South Africa, talking with somebody from the Inkatha Freedom Party and a spokesman for the Afrikaner Volksfront Party. Also, Jim Zaroli reports from New York on the questioning by police of a suspect in the shooting of four Hasidic students in New York. And Scott Simon from Sarajevo revisiting a family he's spoken with before.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Fresh Air's rock and roll historian Ed Ward recently moved to Berlin, Germany. One of the adjustments he says he's been trying to make is to learn a new language and keep a distance from the one he already knows.
When I moved to Germany, I hadn't counted on the pervasiveness of English. Not just the clothing with the English phrases on it, that's pretty international at this point, nor the fact that all Germans who grew up in the West took English in school, and many of them speak it well. No, although there's still plenty of German in my environment, a lot of the time I'm surrounded by English. Take the subway, always a good place to learn a language as you stand waiting for the train to come, staring at the billboards. Germans smoke a lot, so there are plenty of ads for cigarettes. Come to where the flavor is, Marlboro urges us, while Camel suggests we taste the adventure. For years, Peter Stuyvesant has urged come together in its ads, while with Prince Denmark, it's simply the taste. And drum tobacco, perhaps looking at the German recession, reminds us that you can roll your own. Now, this is doubtless because America and tobacco are linked in the European mind. Thank you, Marlboro Man. Although Lucky Strike, probably the American brand, the one that was used as currency in post-war Berlin, advertises in German. It's the other English that I find odd. Take Pennymarkt, a discount supermarket whose trademark is a Pfennig, not a penny. A lot of their house brands have English names, albeit weird ones. Would you want to wash your clothes with Pallor detergent or drink a Final Cola? They also sell Funny cat food, although I don't think it's made by the same company that makes Funny potato chips and other snack food. Nor do I think most women would want to wear the perfume I saw a guy selling on the street the other day, Oppose. I'm dead certain nobody in any English-speaking country would want to use a condom called Pop, and they might feel odd about another brand, Anti-Baby. Then there are the words everybody uses when there are already good German words for them, like Audi offering super leasing. The supermarket over which I live offers a party service for its customers, which I thought was English, but the German word for party is party. Presumably, they never had them before English speakers arrived on the scene. In my neighborhood, you can take ballet lessons at the dance studio, but perhaps you'd rather go to the sports center for fitness or slimming. Afterwards, the ladies can buy cosmetics at the drugstore or the beauty shop. For diversion, there's the theater or concerts, and all Berliners know that the best deals are at the last-minute ticket service. It's not English, a friend said the other night. It's Neudeutsch, or New German. Words like talk show and computer just landed in the language, because there's no German equivalent of the Académie Française to oppose them. Using English means you're appealing to a young audience that feels comfortable speaking it, or in the case of East Germans, wants to, my friend says. Still, it makes me uncomfortable. In a country that's made headlines for being notably unfriendly to certain foreigners, it means that some of us are more welcome than others. I don't know of any circles where Turkish words pepper the conversation as a mark of hipness. Unwieldy and complicated though it is, German's a language that works, with wonderful untranslatable concepts like Lebensmüdigkeit, life-tiredness. I feel like a colonialist when I hear a guy with a German accent selling a product in English on television, so I can only wonder how the East Germans feel. Maybe the Germans will forgive me when they hear me speak, clumsily trying to come to terms with their difficult, but I hope learnable, language.
Ed Ward is living in Berlin and writing for Checkpoint magazine. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tuohy, and Amy Sallet, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin. Research assistants from Louisa Shafia. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Roseanne Arnold about her life, her TV show, and the Kiss episode that she says almost didn't get aired. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.